Amen.
We are in Mark chapter 6, verse 30. What's happened so far in Mark chapter 6? What has occurred? Starts off with what? Say it again. Yeah, prophet without honor. Where? Where is this honor not given to him at? What's that? His hometown, which is? Oh, good old Nazareth. He goes home to Nazareth, and he is astounded, amazed at their lack of faith. And then what happens? Then what do we launch into? Right before John the Baptist, though, what does Jesus do? He sends out the 12. And what's the emphasis on the section in which Jesus sends out the 12? What's the emphasis? Say it again. Trusting God, exactly. Because what does he do? What does he instruct them to do on their ministry? Yeah, they're not to bring hardly anything. And the reason why is because they are to rely on God alone. Period. Which might be a good kingdom principle that we could infuse into our own lives and ministries. But we'll get to that by and by. Then what happens? After he sends them on their ministry, complete reliance and trust on God, he then all of a sudden, what scene pops up? John the Baptist. Who in particular is the central focus of John the Baptist scene? Herod. Which Herod is that, by the way? Herod Antipas, exactly. And what happens with Herod Antipas? Say it again. He's at a birthday party, and what happens? His own birthday party. Yeah, his niece offers a sensual dance that pleases him so that he promises her up to half of his kingdom, which he has to deliver because otherwise he would be quite shamed in front of all of his cronies and buddies and people that he wanted to impress. So what is her sadistic request? Yeah, I'll just take the head of John the Baptist. Thanks, Mom. What a delightful, cheerful family. And ultimately, that's what leads to John the Baptist's death. Now, the question then becomes this. Because notice in verse 30 where we go back to. The apostles gathered around Jesus and reported him all they had done and taught. What would be my initial question based on that verse in light of what just previously happened? Think literally. What does that first verse describe? Verse 30. What does that describe? Yeah, it's describing the conclusion of their ministry, right? It says, and now their ministry is concluded. So then what would my natural question be? Their ministry begins where? In chapter 6, verses, let's say 6b through 13. And it concludes in verse 30. What's my natural question? What? Maybe what did they do? That'd be a good question. What else? Where did they go? What do you mean, why did they stop? Maybe why was it over so quickly? Literally, what is a question I'd be asking? Maybe did they know about John the Baptist? Or to rephrase that type of question, why does Mark interrupt the narrative that's focused around their ministry to talk about John the Baptist? I mean, isn't that a legitimate question? Remember, one of the questions, the key question you're supposed to answer with your exegetical is, if my passage wasn't in here, what would be missing? And for some reason, you have this description of their ministry, and then you have random stuff about John the Baptist, which actually is a flashback, by the way. It is, isn't it? He flashes back to what happens to John the Baptist, and then it comes back to modern times, or to the present moment, and he's back at the end of their ministry. So we don't really get to hear about their ministry while it was happening, although we do know with some sense what happened. But the key question for me is, why John the Baptist in the middle? And let me give you the answer and then hopefully try to build it up later. Here's the reason why. John the Baptist discussion was not primarily about the way in which the harbinger of the Messiah died. What is all wrapped up in John the Baptist's description of his death is Jesus' identity. Why would I say that? More than it is about John the Baptist, the way in which he dies, the way in which he leaves this world, I would argue that it is about Jesus' identity. Why would I say that?
So John's death is about Jesus' identity?
Yeah, that's what I'm asserting. I am asserting that John's death, more than it is just a historical relaying the information of the way in which John died, it's actually Mark trying to reveal to us who Jesus is. Where would I get a notion like that?
You're a theologian. You pull stuff out of the air all the time, Shane.
Where's my reasoning behind this?
John the Baptist is that big of a threat. How much more is Jesus' threat?
Yeah, all the implications of Jesus' identity are off the charts. If John the Baptist was considered such a threat that Herod, even according to Josephus, it wasn't just over a divorce dispute that John the Baptist died. I don't know if Zach read you the Josephus quote, but Josephus actually says John the Baptist was quoted by Herod, or was killed by Herod, to preserve his own political agenda. If John the Baptist was that much of a threat, he had to be dealt with. How much more then would Jesus be? How does the whole situation with Herod start off, though? The disciples are doing their ministry in verse 13. Verse 14, King Herod heard about this, for Jesus' name had become well known. Some were saying, John the Baptist has been raised from the dead. What are they suggesting? A definition of Jesus' identity. Aren't they? Oh my goodness. Their ministry shows who Jesus is. John the Baptist raised from the dead. And then what comes right after that? Verse 15, others say he is Elijah. What are they wrestling with? Jesus' identity. And still others claimed he is a prophet, like one of the prophets of long ago. That's a significant phrase. It may refer to Deuteronomy 18:15. We'll get to that in a bit. But when Herod heard this, he said, John, the man I beheaded, has been raised from the dead. What is the whole story of John the Baptist begin? With a discussion over what? Jesus' identity. This is why I think that John the Baptist is put right in the middle. Is because the provision of God that the disciples are supposed to be relying on in their ministry is directly impacted by who Jesus is. And if Jesus' identity is confused, so too will be your ministry. Is this making sense? Stuart Briscoe once said, or so the legend goes, I've actually asked him where I could get to to quote him on this, and he doesn't ever remember saying it, but I don't have any better options. So Stuart Briscoe once said, the more you tell someone who they are, the less you'll have to tell them what to do. The more you tell someone who they are, the less you have to tell them what to do. If you know who you are, the question of what am I supposed to do just falls to the wayside. You just know what to do. Problem is we don't know who we are because we don't have a clear identity of who Jesus is. We don't have a clear perspective. Is this making sense? You understand who you are as a Christian in light of who Jesus is. And if you can't understand who Jesus is very clearly, you will not know who you are, and therefore you will not know what to do. Your ministry and your mission will be directly impacted. But the more you understand who you are, the less you'll have to be told what to do. Because you just get it. You just do the things that other people don't expect to do, or that other people aren't supposed to do. Why? Because you are Christ's. And in order to understand what that phrase even means, you've got to understand who He is. And I think that's what John the Baptist's discussion's all about, and I think it's still continuing here with the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus' identity, especially contrasted to John the Baptist's, and what we'll find here in a bit, Moses himself. And I think both of those are introduced by the questions of the identity of who Jesus is at the very beginning of John's account. The apostles, verse 30, gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught, which must have been a great moment for them. It's kind of like, you know, you get off a mission field, you have a debriefing session. That's what's happening here. Oh, Jesus, we casted out demons. We taught a bunch of stuff about the kingdom. La, da, la, da, la. It was awesome. Verse 31. Then because so many people were coming and going that they did not have a chance to eat, what does that say right there? It's just getting worse. In a good way. The ministry of Jesus, because of the disciples and because of who he is and what he is doing and what he is saying, is still exploding to the point where even they're even trying to have a conversation over a meal about what they had just done and seen. They can't because there's so many people coming asking for Jesus' help, maybe now even asking for the disciples' help, which would be a thing I think that would make Jesus quite pleased. Because Jesus doesn't get jealous whenever we're successful in ministry, by the way. He's proud of us. It's like whenever my son accomplishes something, I'm not going, well, pff, give me some of that credit. I made you. I'm going, yeah, that's right. That's my boy. That's my daughter. Verse 31, then because so many people were coming and going, they had a chance. They didn't even have a chance to eat. And he said to them, all right, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. The word quiet place is very significant. Because it's actually the exact same word that we find several other places so far in the Gospel of Mark. Eremos. Eremos. Anybody know what eremos means? Eremos. Eremos. Some of you are studying for your Greek quiz. Look it up in there. Eremos.
Wilderness.
Wilderness. Desert. Solitary place. Where have we seen that so far in the Gospel of Mark? Mark chapter 1, actually 1 verse 3. In the quote of Isaiah 40, verse 3, it says, a voice of one calling in the eremos, prepare the way of the Lord. Who is the voice? Who is the Lord? It's interesting that this word, the very first time it is used, connects both of their ministries. I don't think that's insignificant. It's describing the establishment of the kingdom, of which John the Baptist was the harbinger and Jesus was the fruition. The second time the word is used is in 1:4, when it's describing John's ministry. He's out preaching repentance for forgiveness of sins in the eremos. 1:4 says, the desert, the establishment of the kingdom, coming from the eremos. The third and fourth time the word is used is in Mark 1:12 and Mark 1:13, describing the place in which the Holy Spirit thrust Jesus into in order to face 40 days of fasting and temptation by Satan, which ultimately ends in Jesus launching of his ministry to establish the kingdom. You catching a theme with this word? Eremos is attached to what? The establishment of the kingdom because of who Jesus is. The fifth and sixth time the word is used is in Mark 1:35 and in Mark 1:45 when Jesus is praying in the eremos. And Peter comes and interrupts Jesus praying in the eremos because he thinks the kingdom should be established by the popularity contest that he thinks Jesus is winning. Ultimately, Jesus isn't even able to go into the cities anymore because of John the Baptist's heart as well as others, and he is confined to the eremos. The sixth, seventh, and eighth times, the last three times that it gets to the number eight, by the way, is here in Mark chapter 6. Mark chapter 6, 31, 6, 32, and 6, 35. Based on the way in which the word has been used so far, what do you think that the point of bringing the word up again in chapter 6 is going to be? Regarding what? The establishment of the kingdom because of the identity of Jesus. Simple word study that might reveal something theological in the way in which Mark is using it. Let's see what he reveals. Verse 32. So they went away by themselves in a boat to an eremos, a solitary place. But many people who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he was ticked off at them because they kept following everywhere he went. He had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Oh man, sheep without a shepherd. That's a powerful Jewish image. Sheep without a shepherd actually comes from Numbers 27:17. Numbers 27:17. That might be a good test question. A test that, you know, will come tomorrow. Numbers 27:17. Numbers 27:17 is at the end of Moses' life. And he's praying to God and asking God to bring another leader for the nation of Israel. And he says in Numbers 27:17, may the Lord, may Yahweh, the God of the spirits of all mankind, appoint a man over this community to go out and come in before them. One who will lead them out and bring them in, so the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd. What is Moses asking for? For God to provide a new leader for the people of God in the same way in which Moses has been a leader for God. This little phrase right here, sheep without a shepherd, may not just be pointing to something Moses was hoping for, but maybe pointing to Jesus' identity and what he was going to be. The shepherd of the sheep of God. The one that takes care of and protects and liberates the people of God. The one that creates a nation by offering them a new Torah, by offering them a kingdom. In other words, what we are going to see in Jesus' identity in this passage is that he is a new Moses, something that John the Baptist never would have claimed to be. But as a new Moses, he is not just like Moses, he is greater than Moses. A sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. What does he give them? Bread to eat. He starts teaching them. Verse 35, by this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. This is an Eremos. A remote place, they said. It's already very late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. But Jesus answered them, you give them something to eat. Oh, silly Jesus. Always saying ridiculous things that should be rebuked, but no one has the guts to. They said to him, that would take 8 months of a man's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them? That might even suggest that their treasury purse at the time could have afforded it, 8 months' wages. Which may say something about how much money Judas had access to. But they said, is that really a wise use of our money? We need to be good stewards, Jesus. Not just throwing the money to the wind, wasting it on desolate people. We need to be using the money for good things, like perpetuating the ministry of the kingdom of God. And Jesus says in verse 38, how many loaves do you have? This is the key point of the passage. Matter of fact, this isn't just the key point of this passage. This will be the key point of the next scene, the next situation in which Jesus is found walking on water. How many loaves do we have? What is he asked to know the number of? The amount of what? Loaves. And what do they tell him? When they found out, they said, we have 5 loaves and 2 fish. Why? Why do they number the fish? Is that what he asked for? No. What is significant, John? It equals 7. Why is the number 7 significant? We've talked about this before, I think, yeah? Completion. Harkening back to Genesis chapter 1. Thank you. Genesis chapter 1, the point in which God arranged all of the cosmos around the number 7. Therefore, the number 7 from that point on began to develop the connotation of completion. Attached to the food, then, what is being said? Theologically, literarily, what is being said by the number? Yes. How much food do we have, Jesus? The complete amount for you to provide for your people. He asks for loaves, they give him the number 7 by adding the fish. The number is more important than the products. Verse 39, then Jesus directed them. The word directed is very strong. He guided them. He moved them. He placed them. Directed them to have all the people sit down, lie down in groups on the green grass to recline. What does that remind you of if you're thinking of the Old Testament? What passage? Psalm 23. For the Lord is my, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He provides for me. Why? Because he is the shepherd of the sheep, that without him they would be lost. You see, the identity of Jesus, if we reduce it down to just what Moses was, Mark would say you're missing the point. Because while he is a new Moses, he plays the role not just of Moses, but of Yahweh himself. For Yahweh is the great shepherd that may utilize the leaders like Moses to accomplish what he wants for his people. But Yahweh is still the provider. And Jesus starts to function not just as a new Moses, but as Yahweh himself. Then Jesus directs them, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." He makes them lie down, sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties, taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. Notice the emphasis of the number again. 5 loaves and 2 fish. And looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Is this communion, Shane? Is that what this is? You're missing the point if you're asking anachronistic questions. Let the text breathe. He gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to his disciples to set before the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied. We need to talk a minute about the word satisfied. The word satisfied is quite significant to me, not just because it is what happens whenever a shepherd provides for its sheep, but because of where that word pops up in the Old Testament multiple places. One of those is Psalm 107, 8 through 9. It says, "Let them give thanks to the Lord for His unfailing love and His wonderful deeds for men, for He satisfies the thirsty and fills the hungry with good things." Who does that? The Lord. Let them give thanks to the Lord, Yahweh, Adonai. Psalm 132, 13 through 16 says, "For the Lord, Yahweh, Adonai, has chosen Zion, for He has desired it for His dwelling. This is my resting place forever and ever. Here I will sit enthroned, for I have desired it. I will bless her with abundant provisions. Her poor I will satisfy with food. I will clothe her priests with salvation, and her saints will ever sing for joy." Who does that? Yahweh, Adonai. If this text is primarily about Jesus' identity, you got to ask the question the way in which He's functioning. Jeremiah 5:7. God speaking again. "Why should I forgive you?" He says. "Your children have forsaken me and sworn by gods that are not gods. But I supplied all their needs. I satisfied all their needs. Yet they committed adultery and thronged to the houses of prostitutes." And Jesus comes along and He says, the provision not only is going to be establishing your identity, but mine as well. "For I am the shepherd and you are my sheep. For I am the king and you are my kingdom." The more you tell someone who they are, the less you have to tell them what to do. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up, 12 basketfuls. Seriously? That's just way convenient for our theological impact. Because what's significant about that? What? Say it again. Completion. Number 12 is the number of completion usually attached to what? The people of God. Do you think it's an accident that we had 7 things for provision and it ends up in 12 basketfuls? You think that's an accident? Here in just a minute, when Jesus is walking in water, He looks at him and He says, "Did you not understand the loaves?" That's the question He asked them. Why? Because the loaves should have pointed out to them who He was and by extension who they are. He completely provides. Who completely provides? The one that sends you on the ministry. Who sent me on the ministry? God Himself. And Jesus says, "That's me." The reason why you don't have power not only in your own ministry, but also in times of struggle and persecution, is because you forget who I am. When you forget who I am, you will forget who you are. And if you don't know who you are, you'll have no idea what to do. You'll be like flailing around in the water with the storms raging all around you. But if you know who I am, it'll all fall into place. 12 basketfuls, how convenient, of broken pieces of bread and fish. The number of the men who had eaten has 5,000. What's significant about that verse? Say it again. Probably a lot more people. Why? Why would you suggest that? I think you're right. Because it's not counting women and children. Why wouldn't it count women and children? Maybe they weren't significant. However, once we get to the book of Acts, it does count women and children at certain points, does it not? It numbers them. So maybe they're just not significant right now in the kingdom of God, and one day they will be. Ooh, help me. I don't know who said that. Let's just play around with the idea of what that number could be indicating. Number one, think about where are we right now? It's the word we did a word study for just 15 minutes earlier. We're in the Aramos, the desert, right? What happens in deserts? What's that? Say it again.
Revolutions,
right? Political revolutions, we could point back to the Maccabean revolts, began in the Aramos, in the deserts. We could also point back to, matter of fact, Acts 21, Claudius Lysias misunderstands, or what's the word? Misidentifies Paul as the Egyptian rebel that led the people out into the Aramos a short time earlier for a violent revolution. John the Baptist's ministry was in the Aramos, and it was considered a revolution. The Essenes, they retreat into the Aramos because they were a people predicated on a revolution. And Jesus is in the Aramos and establishes 5,000 men. When you are a war, when you are in war, whenever you are in army, you don't count the women and children because those aren't the ones fighting. You count the men. What just happened just a chapter earlier, by the way? We were in some tombs in the Decapolis region. We had a demon by the name of Legion, who 2,000 or so of him ran into pigs, which would have been the symbol of the 10th Fortensis Legion in the same region, and slaughtered all of them, having the people beg him, please leave. Why? Because what this looks like. What does it look like? That this is a politically motivated action against the Roman legions, and we can't have that in our region. And Jesus says, all right, fine. And one of the next places you find Jesus is in the Aramos with 5,000 men gathered together. A legion is anywhere from 2,000 to 6,000 men. Most of the time, anywhere from 4,000 to 6,000. And what we have is Jesus appearing as a new Moses, creating a new people, functioning as Yahweh himself inside of the desert with religious and political overtones, assembling his own legion. Whoops. That'll get you crucified eventually. As a matter of fact, in John chapter 6, people understood the significance of this moment, because at the feeding of the 5,000, the way it ended there is they wanted to appoint Jesus as their king to start the revolution. And Jesus says, it's not the way I roll. Remember that? You don't have 5,000 men being counted by accident. Because the legion that was cast out in Mark chapter 5, the true legion that Jesus actually assembles, is now seen here in Mark chapter 6. And then it's not one that's motivated by the violence and by the swords that the demon legion himself would have wanted to be motivated by. Instead, this whole legion was formed by compassion and complete reliance on the provision of God. Something that will fuel not just their ministry, but Jesus' and yours as well. Verse 45. Euthus, immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida. While he dismissed, actually the word there is divorced, the crowd. And if you understand the background story of John chapter 6, that's basically what he had to do. That's whenever he starts talking about, if you want to follow me, you got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. They're like, does this mean communion? No, communion hasn't started yet. That'll be in about 7 more chapters in John. He says, no, you really have to. Are you asking us to be cannibals? Close. I'm not going to let the mystery just go, though. Matter of fact, it's one of the best sermons ever preached in John chapter 6 with the worst altar call ever. Because he goes down from around 5,000 men to 12. And he looks at them and he says, don't you want to leave too? And Peter responds by saying what? Lord, where will we go? Lord, identity. Where would we go? Because you are what gives us meaning. Because you're what gives us our identity. And if we leave you, there's just nowhere else to go. And Jesus says, fine, hop in a boat. You're good for now. Hops in the boat, tells him to go to Bethsaida, divorces the crowd. After leaving them, he went up on the mountainside to pray. When evening came, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he went out to them walking on the lake. One of the things that a Roman legion, one of their primary duties, was to be on watch throughout the night. And the way in which they did this is the Romans, they would split the night into four watches. And it would go from sundown to sunrise. So what you have is the first watch would naturally be 6 to 9. Second watch would be 9 to midnight. Third watch would be midnight to 3. And the fourth watch would be 3 to 6 in the morning. Jesus is in about the fourth watch of the night. He went out to them walking on the lake. Just nonchalant. I love how Mark just throws that in there. You know, just walking on water. He was about to pass them by. Why? Oh, maybe he was worried about him. And he's like, oh man, they're going to think I'm a ghost. I'll just scurry on by and maybe they won't notice. It's possible. Not likely. Possible. What's that? Maybe he wanted them to see him, or he was just like, if I walk right up to the boat, it wouldn't be as miraculous and cool as if I just was walking by them. I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I was moving along so quickly, I didn't even notice you. Yeah, maybe it was just the fact that he was passing them by, which is emphasizing the fact that they just couldn't get very far. Say it again. What about it?
Isn't there something with Moses looking at the word passing by?
Ooh. Oh, I love John whenever we move into the realm of theology. Because sometimes it can make some of the historical oddities make sense. It's not like Jesus has bad eyesight and just like, I don't even see him. I guess I'll just keep on walking until I run into land or run into them. We know he doesn't have poor eyesight because he's on the mountainside. He looks down and he's able to see them. Right? It's not like he doesn't care their struggle. I do think it's a theological answer. And there's two primary places where this phrase occurs in the Old Testament. Number one. Remember the issue, first of all, that we started the whole class off of, what we're trying to establish particularly? Is what about Jesus? His identity. 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 11. After Elijah's incredible victory over the Baal priests on the Mount Carmel, and then he has these threats by Jezebel threatening his life, and he freaks out and goes running into a cave. So he wipes out a couple hundred priests of Baal, and yet one woman gives him a threat, and he runs off scared. Because God can't protect him from her, he can just protect him for all the hundreds of men. Nevertheless, we do things much worse than that, by the way. God finds his prophet cowering in the cave. And to bring encouragement to his defeated prophet, God says in 19 verse 11, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass you by. Who is about to pass him by? The Lord. Exodus chapter 33, verses 19 through 23. After some deliberation between Moses and God in 33, 12 through 17, Moses makes this bold request in 33, 17. He says, fine, now show me your glory. And in 33, 19 through 23, this is how God responds. He says, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you. I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. But you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. There is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Ultimately, what is that phrase used in the Old Testament to reveal? In both the Elijah story and in the Moses story, what is the phrase pass by intended to reveal? The glory of God, which ultimately points to the identity of God. Because you cannot reveal the power of God and not be making a statement about His identity. They're inextricably linked. And the very fact that Mark describes this as Jesus passing him by, I think more importantly, is pointing to who Jesus is than it is what He is actually doing on the lake. You see the point? It's an odd historical detail unless you understand the theological background. And then you realize it's pointing to something that is much bigger than the historical oddities of walking by the boat that's struggling. It becomes very beautiful because all of a sudden it starts to point to who Jesus is. Inextricably linked to Yahweh. And that's kind of His response. They thought He was a ghost. If you're on the lake and you see a ghost, the way in which the tradition goes is the moment you see a ghost is a sign that you're about to die. So they think they see a ghost, and what do they think their fate is? Death. We've been on a raging storm already, though, you know? Of course, the difference is that they have their lucky charm with them. Because Jesus was at least in the boat, sleeping like Jonah, nevertheless in the boat. But now they forgot Him back on the lake. And even though God has provided for them in their ministry in miraculous ways, even though He just fed 5,000 people, all of a sudden they think that Jesus is the magic charm that they need to have. And since He's not there, they're dead in the water. Literally. Not just figuratively. They cried out because they all saw Him and were terrified. The word literally means to shake together. They were terrified. Euthus, immediately, Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." Some people take this a little too far, and I think other people don't take this far enough. Fact of the matter is this, we have been wrapped around discussions and events that are pointing to Jesus' identity. And the way that Jesus identifies Himself in this verse is, "Take courage, ego eimi." I am. Not it is I, although it is in the attributive position, therefore we could come up with that construction. More accurately, though, ego eimi is the same thing He says in John chapter 8, verse 58 that almost gets Him stoned. He says, "Before Abraham was born, ego eimi." And why did they want to kill Him for saying that? Because of the name of God in Exodus 3:14. For God says, "Moses, you want to tell the people who it is that sent you? You tell them, I am sent you. You tell him, I am who I am has sent you. That's my name. Ego eimi." And Jesus says, "Take courage. Ego eimi. Don't be afraid." Where is their courage found then? In who He is. His identity. Then He climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down. They were completely amazed. That literally means to stand outside of themselves. For they had not understood what about the loaves. What? They were amazed because the loaves. They just totally missed it. The message was in the bread. And that's actually right. It says they missed it for two reasons. Because they didn't understand the loaves, because their hearts were hardened. You see, when Moses had the people of God in the wilderness, in the Eremos, they were starving for food, and God provides them manna from heaven, bread from heaven. God provides that through Moses. Jesus comes into the desert and He says, "I am looking an awful lot like Moses, but you have to understand I'm greater than Moses because I will not just be the one that provides for you food in the desert by praying to God. I'll actually give it to you myself because I am greater than Moses along the lines of God Himself." He's following this. See, what was the message in the loaves was not just the number 7. It was what ultimately the provision of the loaves pointed to about who Jesus was. The message of the loaves is about Jesus' identity, not about cool magic tricks. Is this making sense? Why their hearts were hardened, which would be another thing of they didn't, another way of saying they did not have faith, is they did not acknowledge and submit to the identity and the power of Jesus. Because if you don't know who He is, you won't know who you are, and you won't know how to act. You'll probably just sit and shake. But when you know who He is, when you understand the mystery of the loaves, He becomes more clear. And as a result, so do you. When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret. Ooh, we've been here before. Where? Say it again. Yeah. Where we met our little friend named Legion. This is coming full circle. When they landed at Gennesaret, where were they supposed to be landing? Bethsaida. But they didn't, because of the way in which the winds pushed them in the storm. And they anchored there. As soon as they got out of the boat, people recognized Jesus. Oh no. The pig killer's back. Let's run him off again. No, actually. They ran throughout that whole region and carried the sick on mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went into villages, towns, or countryside, they placed the sick in the marketplaces. They begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak. Huh, they must have heard a story. Because what happened to Jesus right after he left their region last time? A synagogue ruler by the name of Jairus came and fell down because his daughter was dying. And on his way to heal his daughter, what did he run into? A woman with the flow of blood that touched the edge of his cloak and was healed. It must have made it back across the pond. Because they run out and all they want to do is touch the edge of his cloak. And all who touched him were healed. How in the world did this region do a 180 with Jesus? Last time we saw him in 517, they were saying, get out of here. You got to get out of here. Because of, we don't really know who you are, but because of what you've just done, you got to get out of here. Because what you just did could be a political threat and we can't handle that. They may take away everything that we find our identity in, and that is the Romanization that we cling to. Get out of here. And then he comes and he lands. As soon as he lands, they start flocking him saying, we love you, we love you. Heal our people. What changed? Where's the shift? Who he is. How do they know who he is? Say it again. What was the ministry of the demoniac? He comes to Jesus and he says, Jesus, let me come with you. And what does Jesus say? You go back in the Decapolis and you tell everyone what the Lord has done for you. You tell them everything. And he does, and this is the fruit. For in just a short time when Jesus comes back, the ministry of the demoniac rocked the region so much that as soon as Jesus landed, people can't wait just to go and touch the edge of his cloak. Because now he's not just a political threat. Now they understand that he is establishing a kingdom that could be considered by the Roman Empire as something to be dealt with. And yet because of who they know he is, they're okay with anything the world may bring them. Because if Jesus really is who he says he is, they have nothing to fear. These two scenes, the reason why John the Baptist is lobbed right in the middle of the ministry of the disciples, the conclusion of the ministry, leading to, ultimately, the feeding of the 5,000 and into the walking on the water, is because John the Baptist's ministry, both before and at the time of chapter 6, was pointing to the identity of Jesus. And once you understand who he is, you will understand who you are, and then you will know what to do. And if any of that part is unlinked, your ministries and your lives will be a mess. Is this making sense? We've got 2 minutes to spare. I love you. Use that time to study for your test tomorrow morning. See you then.